I believe. Hallelujah, so do I. I believe we all signed a form to agree noble silence. I believe the terms were that we would be asked to leave if we couldn't keep this basic request. Twice today, this has been broken. Once in a whisper. And a second occasion, utterly frivolous. It is hard enough to deal with emotions arising within me in a skillful manner, but when the silence outside is broken, it is very hard. It is so hard to be quiet for, is it so hard to be quiet for a few days? Ask your friends how the meditation is after the retreat. Okay, never mind. Ajahn Chah used to say, you only look at other people and what they're doing. At the very most, 5% of the time, you look what you're doing, 95% of the time. So whatever other people do, that's up to them. But what you do is up to you. So if anyone's broken the noble silence, in my monastery, when somebody does something wrong, I give them the punishment. Those people who read in my monastery know what the punishment is. It's an old Australian punishment. They used to do that to the convicts. They used to give them 50 strokes of the cat. That's what I do to my disciples in the monastery. If they do anything wrong, 50 strokes of the cat. Which means they have to find a monastery cat and stroke it 50 times to learn some more compassion. Okay, so whoever asked that question, yeah, it shouldn't break into noble silence, but people break noble silence. People make mistakes. So don't be too hard on them. And don't be too hard on you, yourself, when you make mistakes. As soon as you made a mistake, forgive. Acknowledge, forgive, and learn. And don't get angry at other people. Sometimes they only break the noble silence for a few seconds. And then you break the noble silence for many, many minutes and hours, thinking, oh, why did they say that? They shouldn't have said that. So if somebody does anything wrong, that's the karma was with them. Don't take their bad actions and stuff it in your mind. You've got enough bad actions of yourself without worrying about other people's bad actions. That's true, that's so people try and be quiet. Okay? So otherwise, it's good job I don't know who it is. So I can't throw anybody out. But instead, have compassion and forgive. But don't do it again. Okay. Next, any questions on that one? Because actually, I think it was probably me who did that. Maybe I should throw me out. Next question. Why we can direct our mind to get the answers to our exams questions, but near impossible to get our mind to concentrate on our breath. Are they the same mind? Yeah, it's just psychology, that's all. Because sometimes you're trying too hard to watch your breath. And because you're trying too hard to watch your breath, you're giving it hardness. No one likes to stay with hard things. So you have to use psychology. When I was a school teacher, I had the opportunity to set one examination for the children in mathematics, and I always rebelled. Even as a school teacher, I was rebellious. I shouldn't have been, but I was. So when I set my examination in mathematics, I put a joke in it, an examination paper. I think it was high school, I think maybe grade 10 or something. I put a joke in the maths paper, and I thought that, you know, the people typing out the question paper would tell the headmaster I'd get into trouble. He said, no, go for it. So I had a joke in the exam paper. And you know what happens when, you know, it's in the about three or four classes in the year, so it's about 120 kids came into the hall to sit the exam. And because I set the paper, I was the invigilator, I was the master sitting up the top there to making sure that no one would cheat. And I was serious, and I said, sit down, you can't speak now. When I tell you to, I start the clock. You can turn over the exam paper and you can start the examination. And so all these kids in front of me, they look so nervous. They were so tense. And then they turned over the paper and they started reading the questions. And then a few... oh, it's one of my wonderful experiences as a school teacher. A few of them read the question. There's a joke in it. And they looked at me and I gave them this big smile. And they all smiled back and then they relaxed. And then they did well in the exam. That's the whole purpose of putting that joke there, was to relax people. And it's an exam, but so what? It's not the end of the world. And even these days, I tell people with examinations, look, kids, if you've got a child who's taking examinations, if they fail this examination, oh, it's so wonderful, they don't have to take any more. If you pass the examination, you have to still take some more until eventually you fail one. Because it's only when you fail an examination, then you can stop. So it's better to get it over and done with early. So it's a big deal. When you make it fun, it's easy to do an examination. When you make the breath fun, it's easy to watch. But if you're hard, then you'll never be able to focus on it. Take away the word concentrate, because concentrate, it gives up the idea of a concentration camp. You all know what that is like, with just big watchtowers in the corner, and anybody who breaks into speech, rat-tat-tat-tat, they get killed. And they get put into the punishment cells when they have a biscuit in the afternoon, or whatever else they do wrong. This is not a concentration camp, this is a compassion camp. This is a meditation. You know what we call the retreats here in Perth? We call it Club Med. Club Meditation. Because when you call it Club Med, straight away, it's relaxed. When you relax, you get much more achievements. Even as a school teacher, when I learned educational psychology, if you can make the lesson fun, the children would learn much more. What you said would go in. If you made it fierce, they wouldn't learn very much. And some children got so afraid they would learn nothing at all. So you've got to relax people first of all. When they're really relaxed and they're at ease, then it's easy to watch your breath. So relax, it's not a big deal. Give yourself time. And then it's not so much concentration where you force the mind onto the breath. It's just the breath is so wonderful, the breath draws your attention to it. Why is it that people can watch their television for hours on end? Do you have to really concentrate to watch, the movie? Those people who like sport, you have to really concentrate to watch the soccer? When you listen to music, you have to think, right, I'm going to listen to this DVD for the next hour. Okay, I'm not going to move. Come on, get your act together. It's natural, isn't it? Because you're enjoying it. I remember when we used to stay up all night meditating in the first year in this monastery in Thailand. Sometimes when it got to 1 or 2 o'clock, I started getting very sleepy. And I thought, oh, it's natural to be sleepy because you haven't been slept all day and it's late at night. But then I started thinking, hang on, about a year before, when I was still a lay person, I used to go to these all-night parties. And I remember quite clearly when I went to an all-night party, when it got to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, I wasn't tired at all. I was really bright and alert at 1 or 2 o'clock at an all-night party. I thought, what's going on? What's the difference between an all-night party and an all-night meditation? I'll tell you what. The all-night party was fun. The all-night meditation, I was no fun at all. That was the only difference. That was why I couldn't concentrate. That's why I got off in Sleth and Torpor. That's why I wasn't getting anywhere. And so I made it important. I've got to put fun in my meditation. Put fun in the breath. For those of you who have trouble watching the breath and you want to put fun into it, this is an original Ajahn Brahm technique. No one else has taught this in the history of Buddhism. There's no other teacher in the world who teaches this. This is original from the source, from Ajahn Brahm. This is watching the breath backwards. Have you ever heard of another teacher teach you to watch the breath backwards? Neither in Malaysia or Singapore or anywhere else in the world. Have you ever heard in LA anyone teach you to do the breath backwards, or in London? No, this is original. How you watch the breath backwards is this. You watch the out-breath first, and then you watch the in-breath. Breathing out, and then breathing in. Breathing out, and then breathing in. You try it. Breathing out, then you breathe again. If you're doing counting, count the out-breath first, then the in-breath. Because, why? You feel it's the same. Now, in theory, it's the same, but you watch it, it looks completely different. And you breathe backwards, out-breath first, then the in-breath. Because naturally, people always start in the in-breath. Okay, breath meditation, breathe in, breathe out. Do the opposite way, breathe out, then breathe in. It makes it completely different. So it's fun, you're messing around. And it keeps your interest. And when it keeps your interest, it's easy to watch. That's why when people first watch the breath the first time, it's easy to watch the breath the first time you do it. If you've never done it before, it's interesting, it's fun. You don't need to concentrate. The interest keeps the awareness in place. So you've got to keep the interest going in the breath. Like breathe backwards. Or if you do walking meditation, walk backwards. Or no, two steps forward, one step back. Two steps forward, one step back. Mess around. And see what happens. Because what happens then is that you're actually creating interest. You're not being like robots, automatons. Here we go. Another day, you sit on the same stool, the same way round, doing the same old thing. Of course you get bored. Make it interesting, make it fun. Do it slightly differently. Then, it's interesting. It's easy to do, yeah.
Do you have a similar suggestion for watching the present moment?
Watching the present moment, yeah. What can we do with the present moment? It's got me tough there, but okay. Okay, just deliberately watch the past. Okay, tell yourself, I'm going to watch the past. Concentrate on the past. But you have to watch the past for the whole hour.
Watch the past?
I don't know, give it a try. The point is, it's that negative, it's reverse psychology. If you tell the mind so that, you know, to watch the present moment, there's something which the mind rebels. So I'm not going to do what you tell me. And so it goes somewhere else. So if you tell it to watch the past, then maybe one might watch the present moment. To my psychology. So whatever it is, you play around, you mess around. Instead of actually watching the present moment, you can instead focus on what you're abandoning. So don't focus on what you're holding. Focusing on what you're letting go. So say, I'm going to let go of the past. I'm going to let go of the future. I'm not going to focus on the present moment. I'm just going to focus on letting go of the past and focus on letting go of the future. So any time I see the future, I'm going to let go of it. Any time I'm going to see the past, I'm going to let go of it. Just like you put two guards on the door of your mind. One is looking to the past, and as soon as the past comes up, bop. Any time one looking for the future in the other direction, any time it sees the future, bang, 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 take it out. So that way that, you know, you're not actually watching the present moment. You're making sure the future and the past don't come in. Try that. Play around. See what happens. It's important to have playfulness in your meditation. That's why if you get too serious, the meditation never works. That's why I do tell jokes. That's why we have fun in meditation. Because that playfulness gives you a bright mind. And that joyful mind is easy to meditate. It's something we actually noticed that all the happy teachers, the ones who played around, would have the best meditation. Because their mind was bright, had energy. So, let's try the next question, which is, the Buddha and Arahats are enlightened. Do they still need to meditate? Why? Will they regress and become unenlightened? Okay, the thing is, do they still need to meditate? That's the wrong question. Do they still need to do things? Do they still need to not meditate? Remember, meditation is the natural state of the mind. Stillness. Sometimes you ask, why do enlightened people actually want to do anything? Why do they want to have their mind move? It's not that, do they still need to meditate? Do they still need to think? Do they still need to move? Do enlightened ones still need to live? And sometimes they say, no, they don't. So they just go out of existence. But if they still need to live, if they still need to do something, if they still need to think, why? It's just out of compassion for others, that's all. They've got nothing to prove anymore. They've got nothing to do. They've finished. They're done. They only stick around for the happiness and well-being of others. So it's not they need to meditate. They can't help themselves but meditate. There's nothing to do. It's shut down. Does your car need to park? Got nothing else to do, that's what it does. That's the nature of your car, is to be still. It's only when you get inside and start, you know, working the pedals, it starts to move. So the arahat is just like the parked car. It doesn't need to go anywhere anymore. It only moves. In other words, it's only out of meditation if there's some purpose to it. Otherwise, the Buddha is still. The arahats don't move. That's their natural state. So, to understand the answer to that very deep question, do the arahats need to meditate? They can't help themselves. That's meditation, is just what the arahat does. That's their natural state. It's only they don't meditate, but it's something important to do. And will they regress and become unenlightened? No, because once you've stopped, you've stopped. Once you're enlightened, you're enlightened. Because it's enlightenment, it's actually seeing things as they truly are. Really understanding the truth. And once you see what's going on, you can never sort of forget that, or you can never become unenlightened. Once you're out, you're out. Once you're dead, I can say that simply, because once you're dead, you become reincarnated. But anyway, once enlightened, always enlightened. But okay. Imagine it was the other way around. You put all that hard work and become enlightened. Then you become enlightened and then you have to do it all over again. Ooh, it's tough. But fortunately, that's not what we have to do. From your description of novice monks falling backwards off the bench during meditation, I gather they wear just their robes. Real adult monks don't wear undergarments too, he said. Okay. Is it particular to the Theravada tradition? How about nuns? I'm just curious. Hope you don't think the question disrespectful. If so, my deepest apologies. Do you come across a case when you've got to run and find the robe in the way? When you've got to run and find the robe in the way. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. They've got only Ajahn Brahm quoting your story about a schoolgirl. Okay, first of all. The only way you can find the answer to that question is that you develop such deep meditation that you have the psychic power of seeing, reading the minds of the monks and the nuns, and have deep insight, deep seeing. And what happens when you've got to run and find the robe in the way? Yes, it certainly does. The robe does get in the way when you run. It's not made for running, this robe. So that's where you have to be very careful when you're using this robe. So you don't run. It's also, there's one of the committee members, Eric, you know, he's got a motorbike. And I had to go into our committee meeting yesterday afternoon. And that's only just a few kilometres up the road here. But he offered to give me a lift back in his bike. And of course I said no. Because what happens, this happened once to me, I was in this forest monastery in the northeast of Thailand. And we had an invitation to like a ceremony at somebody's house. I think somebody had died. And because of the rains, the road was out, there was a big gully in the road, the cars couldn't get in. The only way in and out, they just put a plank across this big chasm, was actually go on a motorbike. There's no choice, you had to go on this motorbike. Never again. Because it's okay being on a motorbike, but these ropes, because they're so loose and they're so big, once you sort of get a little hole in the road, the air gets in there and it all balloons out. You almost end up flying off the flying off the motorbike. You get all this air inside, it's like a big balloon. So that's why sort of wearing robes is also not good on the back of motorbikes. But for everything else, it's great for meditation. You can just—it's nice and loose for meditation, so that you've got no tight pieces of clothing anyway. So it's great for meditating. It's not much good for anything else. That's why it's best to be a meditating monk. Any other questions on that? Okay, next question. Thank you, Ajahn, for your kindness and compassion. Moggallana was killed by bandits, even though he was able to use his psychic powers to escape death. Why did he allow the bandits to commit such an immense bad karma? Wouldn't Moggallana's past karma be relieved when he became an arahant? You mentioned earlier that a non-returner would not return because he had forgiven himself. Okay, this is the story of one of the senior monks of the Buddha, Mahamoggallana. And at the end of his life, he was meditating in a small hut, and these robbers, they came. Not quite sure exactly why they wanted to kill him. But they came in. I don't think it was actually set up. Somebody wanted to kill him. But anyway, they came in there to kill him. He saw them coming. And just as you would expect, he thought, well, I don't really care about myself. I don't want to let these people make bad karma. So he disappeared. Literally, just vanished. He used his psychic power of vanishing. They looked around and couldn't find him anywhere. So they went away. But they came back the next day. The next day saw them come, so he vanished again. And the third day, the fourth day, the sixth day. He vanished 6 days. And then when they came that sixth day, and he vanished the sixth time, he thought, something strange is going on here. Why is this happening to me? And then he looked back into his past lives, and in one of his past lives, he did murder his parents many, many lives ago. Now, if that was in this life, it would stop him becoming enlightened. But because it was a past life, it's a very, very heavy karma. And he realized that there's no way he could escape that karma. He had to actually, it's not a case of forgiving. He's forgiven himself, but it did actually have a karmic result. So the seventh day, they came again, and he let them kill it. So that's why he did that. He saw it was a karma, one of the very, very heavy karmas, which you can't escape from. So he said, okay, let's get it opened up. That's what happened. But he had no anger or ill will to the people who were killing him. Just the same way the Buddha's got this simile of the sword. He said, if bandits come and catch you, and they hold you down, it may be Al-Qaeda, it may be the US Marines, I don't know, and they saw you limb from limb with a not a chainsaw, because that's too quick, with a slow saw, scrunch, scrunch, going through your bones. Now, the Buddha said, if while they're doing that, if you have even one moment of a thought of anger to your torturers, he said, you are not a disciple of mine. He said, you should give them loving kindness and compassion while they're hurting you. Can you do that? Now, that's a tough call. But what it actually did do, the purpose of him saying that, which most people can't do, you have to be, pretty far advanced. But what it did actually say is that there's no justification for anger. Even if they're doing terrible things to you. The worst torture, there's no justification. You're not to say, okay, well, in that particular case, it's okay to be angry. In the worst possible case you could imagine. Said, no, anger is never justified. Giving violence back is never justified. He makes this an extreme case to show that always we should forgive. Now, if you can do that to somebody torturing you, can't you actually forgive your husband or your wife? Because they don't go that far. Can't you forgive the people you work with, your friends, or those people who broke noble silence? Can't you give them compassion as well? And that's the whole purpose of that story. To give that degree of compassion and kindness, even to the people torturing you. Yeah.
There's two small questions. One is, can't karma kind of be forgiving in the same way that people are? And is anger always bad in that it violent, sort of? I mean, is there a neutral anger in some instances?
Okay, so is karma forgiven? Karma is like impersonal, it's just like cause and effect, what goes up goes down. So it's not, it hasn't got that emotional qualities of like forgiving. It's not like being administered by a person or by a being. It's just cause and effect. This is what happens. So it's, you know, beyond those sort of categories and those words such as good or bad. It's just, you do this, is what happens. Action and reaction, that's all it is. So there's some heavy karmas which, you know, you can't sort of escape. But the other one about, what was the other question about? Anger, I was saying, anger is always bad. Really bad. Bad for everybody. What do you want to get angry for? Doesn't help you, doesn't help other people, just gives you heart attacks, increases your blood pressure, makes you more liable to have coronaries. And the other people, when you get angry at them, they don't really listen to you. If they do listen to you, it's only out of fear. And they think, oh, that guy, just, what is he talking about? Psychologically, you can do much, much more when you keep it's cool and when you get angry.
If you see an injustice, doesn't it sometimes motivate you to do something with it?
Sometimes it's an injustice, you can heal that injustice without anger more efficiently. There was that beautiful case, it was in the Truth and Reconciliation Committee or Council, whatever, in South Africa. It was run by Desmond Tutu. And many, many beautiful things happened in that. One particular case, there was one of the South Africans who was in some military police or something, and he was one of the big torturers. No, he'd actually killed many people. That's who tortured him. And he was up there just confessing to some of his crimes. And in the, well, not the audience, in the gallery or whatever, was the wife of one of the people he tortured to death. In the middle of his statements, and it was very, very hard actually to say exactly what he'd done. She got out and walked right over to him, the murderer of her husband, and just hugged him. He said, I forgive you. I love you. It was just a beautiful moment. I can't recreate it just with those few words. Where someone you would think deserved to be angry, who deserved revenge, who saw another way and forgave and even hugged the man who killed her husband. Now that is how healing happens. That really moves so many people. That's how we solve injustices. If you get angry back, you just create another injustice. You create more fear, more violence, more war. Forgiveness is the best way. That's what religions are supposed to teach and supposed to be doing. Turn the other cheek. That's what Jesus said. Buddha said that anger doesn't stop with more anger and violence, only stops with forgiveness and loving kindness. That's the only way which short circuits the whole process. You killed me, or you killed my brother, and I'm going to kill your daughter. You know, the 4 meter one? Ah, yeah, then, you know, you're going to kill me back, or you're going to kill my friends, I'll kill your friends. You kill my city, I'll kill your city. It just keeps on going. So, you know, we should grow up and stop this anger business. And in Buddhism, there's no justification for anger. Ever. Anywhere in the teachings of the Buddha, that anger is a defilement of the mind. It's never justified. I'm so clear on that. That's why in Buddhism, you can never actually justify a war. Even with the sort of smartest scholars, you can't find any loophole in what the Buddha said to actually justify killing another person. For any reason. So it's a powerful teaching. Some people say it's idealistic. Some people say it doesn't work. In one lifetime, maybe it doesn't work. But for many, many lifetimes, it does work.
Does that mean that when Jesus lost it in the temple, he...
That's right, yeah, because the Buddhists who think, turning over the... What do you do that for? It's a stupid thing to do. It's not what you Sweden. If you're a Buddhist monk, you probably just go up there and ask for donations. Yeah. And that should be mercifully about these things. When one becomes an arahat, an after parinibbana, does it mean that the existence is gone? Or is it just another plane of existence? How does one choose to become a Buddha instead of an arahat? Is it through the Mahayana Bodhisattva way? There are Buddhas who teach and Buddhas who don't teach. Why? Shouldn't all Buddhas teach to give wisdom to all sentient beings? So you're talking about arahats enlightened. Now, the only way to answer that is you become enlightened and find out for yourselves. That's what we say is Pachatangwe Ditabo Winyuhi. This Dhamma is to be experienced, each wise person for themselves. Because if I told you, would you believe me? Would you believe me because I say it? That's Ajahn Chah said that once. This guy asked him, he said, look, so if I always want to find out, is there reincarnation or not reincarnation? So he said, look, you know, Ajahn Chah, you know, you're a famous teacher, I'll ask you. Is there or isn't there? You tell me. Ajahn Chah replied to him, said, if I told you, would you believe me? You know, the people who just believe what other people say, they're stupid. Because you know, how can you actually know what other people say, whether it's true or not? You're just being gullible. So this man said, okay, if you told me, I wouldn't believe you. So Ajahn Chah said, well, there's not much problem in telling you then. This is brilliant. This is playing around all the time with these people. Again, would you believe me if I told you? When we become the arahat after paying the bond, does it mean that existence is gone? Number one, what is an arahat? Number two, what is parinibbana? Number three, what is existence? You find out what existence is. And then you'll be able to answer that question for yourself. Otherwise, if people go arguing, I tell them the answer to that, and they said, don't believe me. So now that can't be right. I said, well look, what's the point of me telling you if you don't believe me? So, the answer actually is that everything is gone. Poof, it's vanished. That can't be right, you say. I've worked so hard to become enlightened. I've just done all these retreats. I've given all these donations to make enough good karma. I've kept all these precepts. I haven't been indulging like everyone else's. I've been a good boy. I've been a wonderful girl. And I've tried so hard. I've sat through all these meditation retreats. I've gone through so much pain. Now I'm enlightened. Does that mean I can't enjoy it? Can I have at least one eon of happiness before I go poof and disappear? No. You're all gone. Gone. Is that the one choose to become a Buddha instead of an arahat? The only difference between an arahat and a Buddha is just timing. That's all. Just timing. The Buddha is an arahat who becomes an arahat at a time when there's no teachings of Buddhism around. So it becomes enlightened, like our Buddha Sakyamuni, and there was no Dhamma around. There were no other teachers. Call that self-enlightened. So he could start it again. Other than that, there's no difference. For example, from the time when the Buddha was the Buddha, he makes many, many stream winners, once returners, non-returners, arahats himself. Those who are stream winners and once returners, some of them will come back, especially once returners, at a time when there's no Dhamma available. Because they're once returners, in that life they become arahats, fully enlightened. And that may be a time when there's no Dhamma available, no Buddhism available. If they're going to teach, they will become Buddhas, the next Buddha. If they don't teach, they'll be called what's called Pacheka Buddhas. What's the difference? Why do some arahats teach, why do some don't? Basically because sometimes nobody asks them. That's all. If you don't ask, you don't do. Who asked the Buddha, our Buddha, to teach? There's this guy called Brahmasahampati, one of the gods in the Deva realm. And if that he hadn't asked the Buddha to teach, Sakyamuni would have been a Pacheka Buddha. He needed to have all that will, all that causes had just been all wiped out like a plain sheet. A plain slate. He needed someone to actually to ask him. That's all he needed, one person to ask him, and that set off the whole Buddha period. So as one of my novices said, well, if that means Brahma Sahampati is one of the gods, if that means that it was him who actually was important to start this Buddha cycle, he said, thank God for Buddhism. So yeah, that's actually pretty smart. Yeah, thank Brahma Sahampati for Buddhism. Otherwise, if no one asked, he wouldn't talk. Even as monks, we can't actually give it at any teaching if we're not asked. So you've got to ask first of all, and then we go and give a talk. So that's what happens. And how does one choose to become a Buddhist servant? This is the Mahayana Bodhisattva way. No, it's just timing, that's all. It doesn't that one chooses, I'm going to become a Buddha, or I'm going to become just an ordinary arahant. Just timing. If you haven't just timed it, so you be born a Sakadagami, a once return of time, and there's no other Buddhas around, then you are a Buddha. There's no extra reward being a Buddha and arahant. Poof, both go at the end. Is there a reason why India is a chosen place for Buddha to be born there and found Buddhism there, but not flourish the religion there? In some texts, there is reason why Buddha's mother should pass away after he's born. Why is that so? Thanks. You know that if anyone has ever looked at geology, you know these tectonic plates? You know, just like all these continents, they always keep on moving from place to place. And I think there used to be like a big continent many thousands of millions of years ago called, what was it called? Gondwanaland, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Gondwanaland. Because India and West Australia, thousands of years ago, were together. It's true. Ask any geologist.
It's true.
And the west of Australia, where you're sitting now, was right next to what we know as India now. It was. There was no difference. There was not even a creek separating Perth from the east coast of India. So, maybe where you're sitting now, Buddhas in the past walked and meditated. Why have we got such good monasteries in Perth? Interesting. But it's true, because Perth was right next to India, squashed against it. Separated long ago. That's the theory of the tectonic plates. So, who knows where India will be next? It's always moving. I don't know. But why did the Buddha's mother pass away after he was born? Why is that so? I don't know. Anyone got any suggestions? I don't know that one. Supposed to pass away after 7 days. Haven't got a clue. Anyone have any clues about why the Buddha passed away after 7 days? Buddha's mum. Yeah.
Sure, he didn't develop attachment.
Okay, maybe that might be so, because you know what mothers are like. Now, don't do this, do that, now you've got to get a good job. These days, probably the mother will send them to university and make sure they get a job as a doctor or a lawyer or something. I don't know, basically. Anyway, that next question. Could you kindly explain how the psychic powers come about? Is there a special practice to follow? How many people knew that question was going to come up today? How many people could predict that? How do psychic powers come up? Psychic powers is just the energy of the mind. When your mind becomes empowered, then it's likely to do things. And how do you empower the mind? By stop all the energy going to thinking and worrying and asking silly questions like this. You'll find the energy just goes into the mind, into knowing. And you know that things are happening just when the food starts to taste more delicious than it should. When the carpet is just more beautiful. It's cheap carpet which they got here. It looks really wow. Look at all the things going on in there. When the world starts to go to a different depth, and a different level of beauty. And you know it's not the carpet, because you came in here and the carpet was just ordinary, cheap. But now it's your mind is becoming strong. You can start to see the beauty in things. You know the mind is starting to have power. And there are times when you know what I'm going to say, or you know what somebody's going to do. Little ideas come into your mind. Your mind is developing power. But when it does, keep it quiet. Because if you let on that you can read other people's minds, the CIA will get hold of you and they will use you for interrogating in all parts of the world. If you can levitate, you're even in worse trouble. The Singapore government will get you to go in the high jump in the Beijing Olympics. You can high jump and levitate. So whatever you do, and if you get any sort of psychic power, you get all these scientists who will spend thousands of hours of your time trying to prove you're making it up. And you just get bombarded by all these scientists. Because they're doing their PhD, and they want to make sure that they get their PhD or their Nobel Prize by proving that yes, there is psychic powers. It's all right for them, but you just have to do all the work, they get all the Nobel Prizes. And so they just bother you. You just become like a laboratory rat, like a freak, like a circus star. And wherever you go, they won't want to listen to your teachings. They just want you to perform your psychic feats. Please, come on, can you levitate? Just once, come on, just one, please, just for me, come on. And you'd never hear the end of it. If you just levitated once, then you would be able to keep your mouth shut. You go out and tell other people, and then you get the TV cameras, and then you get the reporters, and then you get all these other people trying to prove that you're wrong. And just there won't be an end of it. They won't come here to listen to teachings. They're just, you're a freak. So that's why the Buddha said, do not exhibit your psychic powers, if you have any. Keep them to yourself. But, the Buddha said, there is one psychic power which you can exhibit. He said it's the only psychic power which the Buddha praises. So it's the only psychic power worth anything. He said that's the ability to teach and to serve and help other people by giving them the Dhamma. That's the only psychic power which you're allowed to show. The power of teaching Dhamma. So that's psychic powers, how to develop them, and how to keep them quiet, so no one can ever know. Imagine I could predict the future. How many of you would come up and, out of compassion, oh Ajahn Brahm, I've got a wife, I've got 2 4-meter children. Oh, they're so hungry, can you please tell us the lottery numbers? Can you please, out of compassion, look, I've got this new project in Singapore. We're building a new temple. We can't raise some money. Just you tell me what the numbers are going to be in the casino tonight. So there'll be all these hard luck stories that come into you. How can you choose between them? So you have to be quiet. Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn, this morning you spoke about restlessness, but what about its counterpart, remorse, sometimes called excitement and depression? There is an epidemic of depression today. Hordes of people on Prozac, an increasing teenage self-harm and suicides. Can you explain this trend? It's because people don't go to the Buddhist temple enough. They don't learn meditation enough. Now, the main reason for depression is actually probably selfishness. One of the best ways of overcoming depression is to do social work, do charity work, go and help others. Go and visit an old people's home and or an orphanage, go and adopt. Like a friend, you can go and visit once a week. Someone who's lonely, go and help. But when you start serving others, you think you're doing this as a service, as a gift to others. But you get so much back in return. You feel good about yourself. you feel your life has much more meaning. Depression just disappears. If you haven't got a charity, or go work in a Buddhist temple, go and volunteer, do some sweeping, answer the phone, or help out. You're doing something for others. You're doing a service. You're helping. How can you ever get depressed if your life has such a meaning? Well, I told a story last Wednesday at my monastery, because Venerable Chulika, he had his sister and his brother-in-law visiting. Many, many, many years ago, maybe about 24 years ago, I think, I was visiting England. And I just started this monastery down at Chitthurst. And Ajahn Sumedho was trying to get me to stay over there, so he gave me a tour around. It was actually Ajahn Chah told me to go back to Thailand. But we went up to Obak in the northwest coast of Scotland, because Ajahn Sumedho was teaching a retreat, and I was the monk who looked after him. We call it Upatai, or what's the word? Like his attendant, that's the word I was looking for. I was his attendant at this retreat. So when there was interviews, because of our rule, if there's interviews with a lady, the monk has to be there. You know, you've seen all these scandals they have, like with Catholic priests, Anglican priests, and then Jewish rabbis, anybody. Because if a monk is alone with a lady, who knows what happens in there? You can get sort of accused of things you never did. So because of that, we always have to have a chaperone in there. So I was Ajahn Sumedho's chaperone, his attendant, during the interview periods. And this one time, this lady came in, and I've heard all the stories before, and I was getting quite sleepy and quite bored, frankly. It's the same old trouble. I've got a restless mind. I can't watch the breath. I've got a restless mind. I can't watch the breath. Here we go again. This lady came in, and she said something different. She came in and said, look, I've come in here, not to talk about my meditation, I've come in here to thank you for saving my life. And the way she said it, it just really woke me up. I said, what do you mean? What has this monk done? And she sat down and told the story that she'd been on this retreat the year before at the same place. And you know what happens on a meditation retreat? You're supposed to keep the 8 precepts, so you're not supposed to take any alcohol or drugs. And not realizing exactly what that meant, she thought the Valium, which she'd been taking for so many years, was also prohibited. So she stopped taking her Valium. Apparently, as a teenager, she had some sort of emotional problem, like every teenager has. And the doctor, instead of, he took the easy way out, just prescribed her Valium. And after a few weeks, she was hooked on the Valium. And she was taking it for so many years. Now, during the 9-day retreat, she thought she couldn't take it anymore. So she stopped her Valium. Now when you take in noble silence, and when it's like a kind, compassionate retreat, she could do that. It was so supportive. She didn't have to do anything. She didn't have to interact with people. And so she managed to do it for the 9 days, to let go of her Valium. But then after 9 days, she thought, well, I've done it for 9 days. Let's see if I can continue not taking the Valium. So she made a resolution. She would not pop any more pills in her mouth. The problem was, if you know, you know where Oban is, it's on the northwest coast of Scotland, she had to catch a bus and then a train back home, which meant getting the bus to Glasgow and then getting the train in Glasgow station. Huge city, a busy railway station. She said that she almost lost it many times. She always went absolutely crazy. She said it was just a great achievement just to get on the train. Because when somebody's that sensitive, they're coming off this drug, Valium. And then she managed to get herself home, and she said, her words, I always remember this, she said she spent the next 2 months just sitting in a chair. She couldn't do anything, because the effects of that drug wore off. But it did wear off. She could handle that because of the mindfulness, the letting go, the compassion, all these teachings which you learn here. Those empowered her to bear with just the effects of the Valium getting out of her system. And after 2 or 3 months, she was free. And she remained free of that drug. And she said before, Now she knows what it's like outside of that dependency. So before it was like I was living in a cloud, a half-life, just like in a twilight zone of not really being awake, not really being asleep. Could never really appreciate anything, even the smells, the sights, were just half-colour. Now I said I'm awake. Now I'm alive. I'm free. So I've come here to thank you for giving me that freedom. For giving me my life back. You saved my life. When I heard that, I was really profoundly moved. And I made a resolution there and then, in my whole monastic life, that no matter how many years I stay as a monk, if only one person comes up to me and says that, thank you for saving my life, Asimba, then my whole monastic life, not monastic, my whole life has been worthwhile. And of course, that many of you have heard that story before, that many times people have come up and told me that if it wasn't for you, they'd be dead. Now imagine what I feel in that position. Can I get depressed? It's impossible for me to get depressed when you've helped somebody else. That's why one of the great remedies for depression is serving others. Doing something good with your life. Then you never get depressed. You just look back at what you've done. Wow, look at all the stuff I've done. I've really helped somebody. You can never get depressed then. So, being selfless, giving service, when it's the me, what I want, what I need, looking at yourself, that's very depressing. So that's one way of overcoming depression. And remorse comes along. It's not so much remorse, but guilt. You've done something wrong, and you want to be punished. And because you want to be punished, you never allow yourself happiness. This nun, some years ago, she was staying in a retreat in my monastery. She started to get some deep meditation, got this nimitta stage. She was really close to a jhana. But then she blew it. Because she thought, she came and told me afterwards, she said, I thought I don't deserve such happiness. I thought, oh, why do you say that? You do deserve happiness. You do deserve all the bliss in the world. But she had this guilt trip. Lack of self-esteem. Maybe other people can get jhanas, but I don't deserve it. That fear of happiness, the fear you don't deserve freedom, is a very strong psychological barrier to us. And many of you might come across that barrier yourself. And the meditation may actually start to work, and you get bliss beyond your comprehension. And something might come up and say, not me, I don't deserve this. And you'll interrupt the process. And sometimes it'll take years to get back. So please believe this. You do deserve all the bliss in the world. You do deserve happiness. You do deserve freedom. You do deserve enlightenment. Unless you killed your mother or father in this life or shed the blood of the Buddha. You haven't done those things. You deserve it. So when it comes, let it happen. Don't be afraid. Sometimes the remorse just cripples one. One looks what one has done in the past, thing, I don't deserve to be free, I don't deserve to be happy. That's the problem. So you deserve to be happy. This is Prozac suicide. Instead of taking Prozac, just go and do some service. Help others. Be compassionate. Be kind. Next question. You have been teaching us to become kind and compassionate. See? It flows on seamlessly. To all beings and even objects. So is it easier to cultivate kindness and compassion of a person? If a person to start with a non-meat eater, vegetarian. Okay. Your compassion should be even to all people. So vegetarians and to meat eaters. And even to cannibals. Somebody told me this joke, it was that Ainsley's joke. He said, if a vegetarian is someone who eats vegetables, then is a humanitarian someone who eats humans? Well, it sounds like it, doesn't it? A humanitarian, a vegetarian. Somebody's veggies, they're vegetarian. They eat humans, they're humanitarian. So all these cannibals are humanitarians. So, your kindness, compassion to all beings, and even objects. So it's easier to cultivate kindness, compassion for a person to start with a non-meat eater, vegetarian. Okay. Just be kind to all beings, whether vegetarians or non-vegetarians. Be kind to yourself. Obviously, it's better if you can give up meat, if it's at all possible. I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. I had to even give up vegetarianism to become a monk. I still remember to this day that when I broke my vegetarian vow, I took a shrimp. It's a Thai temple in London. Because they told me, look, you can't keep to be a vegetarian because as a monk, you've got to accept whatever you're given. You've got to be able to eat anything. So I remember just, I saw this shrimp, this being, this body, this corpse, was once alive. It probably had sort of, you know, a mother and father and a wife and their children. And there it was, it's the whole body, you can see its eyes and everything, its whole corpse. And so, no, I can't do it, no, you've got to do it, no, you can't do it, it's a great struggle. So I closed my eyes and put it in. Oh, I felt sick. It was only a shrimp. But to me, it was just this amazing, enormous thing. But you had to do that. So that don't be critical of other people, if they're meat eaters, or if they're vegetarians, or if they're humanitarians. Just don't be critical about this, because sometimes that's the best they can do, that's all they can do. But with yourself, see what you can do. But be kind and compassionate to yourself. You can be a vegetarian, fine. But don't go around criticising others. I remember this one occasion when I was a strict vegetarian. My girlfriend invited me for dinner, and she put on this really lovely meal, but she forgot I was a vegetarian. I don't know how she could forget, she should know. She made this meat curry, and I refused to eat it. I just said, no, I'm not going to eat that. And I was just, nowadays I felt this, you terrible man. You know, this lady went to all this trouble making a dinner and I just spoiled it. I should have just eaten that meal out of compassion for her. I loved animals, but I hated people. That was my problem. So, you know, I thought of that, and sometimes vegetarians would be so cruel. So if you are a vegetarian, don't criticise others. If somebody, if you've got a boyfriend, girlfriend, they ask you out and they give you some meat, just eat it. Out of compassion for them. Dear Ajahn, I'm getting more and more peace in my meditation. Great. For me, I notice that peace occurs only after I get tranquility with the body and the body disappears. That's what's supposed to happen. However, when I arise in my meditation and evaluate what went on, I always find that after body tranquility, my mind has very little activities and it feels like there's nothing much in there, nothing much going on. I wonder if this is dullness, and I wonder why the breath doesn't come up. Okay, what happened there, if it's after body tranquility, the body's completely disappeared, then you get some stillness. The next thing to do is just stay there and allow energy to come up. Especially the later parts of the retreat, you get more mental energy in that stillness. The stillness becomes more vivid. It's not just ordinary peace. It's this vibrant, brilliant, beautiful peace. Because peace has got different layers. There's ordinary peace, and there's bright peace, and there's joyful peace, and there's happy peace, and there's blissful peace, and there's blissed out of your skull peace, and more ecstasy you could ever imagine peace, and ecstasy as you're blowing apart peace. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's what happens. So, it starts off with stillness. Just wait there. And that stillness is pregnant with energy. Shh. Something is about to happen. Then wait. And allow that stillness to develop. And it will develop into power, into energy. Because, as I said many times already, the energy, if it goes into doing things, you waste all the energy. If you're not doing anything, the energy can only go in one place, into knowing. Shh, don't do anything. Be still. And the energy starts to build up. It's peace upon peace upon peace. Contentment upon contentment upon contentment. It builds up the power of happiness and energy. You get energized. You're alive. You can't sleep at night because of power. So that's what you should do. You're doing well. Just carry on. Here we go. To concentrate on my breath and to bring up mindfulness. How does one control both effectively? Okay, if you control the breath and bring up mindfulness, then you all go all over the place. You don't get anywhere because too much control is too much tightness, too much doing things. You may be able to watch the breath for a short time, but eventually it will just fall apart. Stop trying to control things. Try and work with things. That's the way to go. I was telling somebody today that when I went to see Ajahn Liam, who was taken over from Ajahn Chah in Ajahn Chah's old monastery, Wat Pa Phong. He's a great monk, Ajahn Liam. I like him very much. He's very, very wise. And one of the sayings which we have when abbot meets abbot, we ask, are your disciples easy to teach? Do you find your disciples easy to teach? That's what you ask, you know, other teachers. And if I saw Sister Wayama, I'd say, Sister Wayama, are your disciples easy to teach? And when I asked this question to Ajahn Liam, he said, they are, they're really easy to teach. They couldn't be easier. I said, what do you mean? How do you do that? He said, that's easy. If they want to do this, I let them do it. If they want to go over there, I let them go over there. They're easy to teach. And I thought, hang on, because I know he's a very strict monk. What do you mean? He's actually talking about his mind. He lets go. That's why his mind is easy to teach. When you let go, the mind doesn't go anywhere. In the Chinese tradition, in the art of war, there is the story of the general with the best discipline in the whole imperial army. And the emperor asked him, what's your secret? Why do your soldiers always do what you follow your orders? And he said, it's easy, emperor. I only give orders such as these. I only tell my troops to do what they want to do. That's why they always follow orders. Now that's a smart general. So can't you do that with your mind? Only tell your mind what it wants to do. It always follow orders. You have perfect self-discipline. So it's easy, isn't it? Just tell your mind to do what it wants to do. And then it always does what it's told. Now, you may ask, but how can I tell my mind to sit still? How can I tell my mind to watch the bread? And the answer is, how did the general tell his troops to get up early in the morning? How did, you know, he tell his troops actually to go into battle when they might get injured? How did he get them to train? And the answer was obviously motivation. He motivated his soldiers to want to get up early in the morning. He motivated his soldiers to want to train. He motivated his soldiers to want to go into battle for patriotism, whatever else it was. Because of motivation, which was, you know, in place, when the general ordered his troops to get up early, they wanted to get up early. When he ordered them to go and train, they wanted, they couldn't wait to get into training. And when they wanted them into battle, ah, great! They couldn't wait, yeah, let us go. You can see just how he had perfect discipline in the army, while they always followed orders. Now, when you watch the breath, is it the case that, yeah, let me at the breath, I can't wait? Or is it, I don't want to watch the breath? When you wake up in the morning, is it, great! I'm on retreat, 3 o'clock in the morning, an extra hour, because Ajahn Brahm only gets up at 4 o'clock. Oh, marvellous, wonderful, way, let's get out there. Or is it, only 3 o'clock, I'll take another couple of hours. Are you motivated to get up early in the morning? Are you motivated to sit on your seat? Are you motivated to watch your breath, to be in the present moment? It's motivating, that's how you concentrate. If you've got no motivation, you're wasting your time. Just like the general sending these rebellious troops into battle. No, they don't want to go into battle. You must go into battle. Oh, okay, but I'm not going to shoot. Or I'm going to run away when you're not looking, which is what your breath does. As soon as you're not looking, you lose your mindfulness. It runs off into some fantasy, into some dream, into some memory of the past or plan for the future. Because you're going to motivate yourself. Remember, you can become enlightened. You can get in this retreat a bliss better than sex. Well, that motivates a few people. It motivated these prisoners. That's one of my lines, which really got a lot of prisoners meditating. You can develop psychic powers. That motivates a few people. Whatever it is, when you get the motivation, then you want to actually get up in the morning. You want to actually do it. That's actually how you motivate yourself to watch the breath. And the greatest motivation is just happiness. It's just so wonderful to be able to watch the breath once you get into it. So nice, just being peaceful, being free. Freedom is a great motivator. So once you have a little bit of experience about what meditation is, and that little bit of happiness you've had will motivate you to meditate for the rest of your life. Any questions about that? Next question. Dear Ajahn, okay, I can observe my breath in and out nicely, but I'm not able to see the centre of my breath. Why? Please help. Thank you very much. I don't try. Just leave your breath going in and going out. You're doing really, really well. So just stay with that. Don't do anything. If you not do anything, the centre of the breath will come to you. You'll focus in. It's nature. So don't try. Just stop controlling. Stop doing things. Just rest. And the centre of the breath will be right there. It's come to you, and you haven't been doing anything. What are some exercises I can do to get over fear of enlightenment and excitement regarding limiters? I've already tried being aware of the feelings, but that does not seem to be enough. Okay. Best exercise, if that's a trouble, you're getting some limiters, but you get afraid when they come up, do the exercise of programming your mindfulness. Tell yourself, look, just at the beginning of every meditation, if a nimitta comes up, I will not get excited, I will just be at peace. If a nimitta comes up, I will not get excited, I'll just be at peace. If a nimitta comes up, I will not get excited, I'll just be at peace. Tell yourself, give yourself those suggestions. Make it clear, listen very carefully, give it full attention, and after the third time, forget about it. And it happens, especially in the very deep meditation, when the mind is very subtle, your nimitta comes up, you're about to get excited, but that instruction then kicks in and overcomes excitement. It's not you do anything, the mind says, shh, don't get excited, be at peace. The mind does that, subverbally. And instead of excitement, you calm. If you try and do that, and when a nimitta is arising, it just doesn't work because it just is too coarse. You have to give the instructions when the mind is, when you're just starting meditation, and that is the signal, that is the instruction, what to do when that particular event happens. Program your mindfulness. And that's the best thing. And then the nimitta comes up. After a while, you get familiar with the nimittas, you get to know them well, and as you get to know them well, you get more familiar, then the fear disappears. You know all about the nimittas. You're used to them, so you know exactly how to deal with them. So familiarity is important. Then you don't get excited, nor do you get afraid. Sorry? Another part was a question. I have already tried being aware of the feelings, but that doesn't seem to be enough.
Fear of enlightenment.
Fear of enlightenment. Oh yeah, because if you come fully enlightened in this retreat, there's only two choices. Only two. It's not up to me, it's not, it says nature. It's the law of karma. It's just the way things are. Either you become a monk or a nun, or you die. And that's it. I'm sorry about that. You've got no choice. 7 days you have. If you don't ordain as a monk or a nun, that's it. So forget about your husband, forget about your work, forget about your kids, forget about all your money and all the other things you like to do.
Sorry, that's it.
But it's no problem at all, because once you're blind, you've got no attachment, so you don't worry about those things. Is that my husband? Is that my wife? It's not mine, it's just wife, that's all that's happened. Dear Ajahn, after a person attains fourth jhana, he will not come back to this samsara world, so where does he go? Oh, fourth jhana, he still come back. Fourth jhana is state of meditation, because that stops and he can come back again easy. But it's the fourth level of enlightenment, the arahant doesn't come back. Where does the enlightened one go afterwards? The enlightened one wasn't here to begin with. So if there's no one here to begin with, how can they go anywhere? When I was doing walking meditation, my mind felt very tired. So I meditated on, I will die, that's for sure. Amazing, I feel lighter, more energized, inspired. I sat down on a chair and contemplated on my death. After a while, it struck me to tell my children not to put shoes on me when I die. I don't know whether I imagine this or not, but it is not a nice sight to see a skeleton with shoes on. Many of you know that sort of I spend a lot of my time doing funeral services. And so I know the funeral directors in Perth really, really well. And they tell some really nice stories. One of the nicest stories was there's one guy who put in his will that he wanted to be buried in the ground, but standing up. So the poor funeral director had to do a very deep hole, but a very narrow hole. So instead of actually lowering the coffin down horizontal, they had to do it vertical. It really gave them so much problems. But it was in the guy's will. They could argue with him afterwards. They couldn't say, now can you change your will, please? He was dead. So he did that, I think, just to get his own back from the funeral directors and create trouble for him. There are people like that, you know. They're just so rebellious. Any way they could possibly make trouble, they do. And that's what he did. I said, what's wrong with a skeleton with shoes on? Well, it's great to have a skeleton with shoes on and a tie and glasses and whatever you can put on the skeleton. Yeah, okay. Next question. Go. Ajahn, when one feels nice with memory or in a beautiful place, in our conscious mind wishing family, friends or pets would share this joy. Is this how metta is said? Yeah, that's okay. Because you know, when you're feeling very happy and peaceful, if you think of your relations, your loved ones, or especially people who are sick, when you're like that, you've got actually something to give to them. You give them a share of your joy. And if they're close to you, you've always got some psychic connection, even if you don't think you are pretty highly developed. There's always some connection there. And you know that because it may be a brother or a sister or a parent or a child who has an accident. You can feel it. I told the story in the interviews. There was this fellow in Victoria, he was a vet, he had finished work on a Friday afternoon, and he was going off into this country house about 2 hours outside of Melbourne for the weekend. They're having a party with his friends. So he was in a really good mood, finished his work, having a lovely weekend, a nice party with his friends in the countryside. But on the journey, halfway on the journey, he was overcome with this really strong emotion, this immense sadness. He hadn't got a clue why, but he was so strong he had to stop the car and get out and start weeping. Completely out of character, he couldn't understand it, but that emotion was so strong he just cried his eyes out. And you know, when he sort of stopped weeping, he pulled himself together. He didn't know why, but you know, he got back in the car and started driving to the country house. When he got to the country house, there was a message for him. His dog had been run over and killed at that precise moment. And he wrote about it, and I think it was the Melbourne Age.